From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Whatever gets you through the night. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tomorrow would have been John Lennon's 53rd birthday. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Lennon with two of Terry's interviews from our archives. First, Cynthia Lennon tells us what it was like to be married to John Lennon in the early days of the Beatles, when she had to hide their marriage. Then Lennon's second wife, Yoko Ono, talks about making the transition from an independent avant-garde artist to wife of one of the world's biggest celebrities. Also today, rock historian Ed Ward plays some of the music that influenced Lennon. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has written to the Prime Minister of Italy seeking closer cooperation between the two countries in the United Nations operation in Somalia. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
President Clinton's letter to Italian government leader Carlo Ciampi stressed the need for a new approach to bring about a reconciliation between Somalia's warring factions. The U.S. president's letter also called for Italian help in avoiding further losses on the ground and in preventing more weapons from reaching Mogadishu. A few months ago, relations between Washington and Rome were severely strained after the U.S. accused Italian troops in Somalia of acting in an excessively conciliatory manner toward warlord Mohamed Farah Aidid. Italian government circles interpret the letter as Washington's acknowledgement that the Italian policy of negotiating with Somali factions and seeking a diplomatic solution was not completely off track. And today, Ciampi proposed the appointment by the UN of a mediator who would negotiate between the warring sides. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
A Justice Department report issued today says that sect leader David Koresh was to blame for the deaths of more than 80 of his followers during an FBI raid on the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. The report was prepared by Edward Dennis, a former U.S. prosecutor. Dennis concluded that the fire that destroyed the compound last April was either an act of mass suicide, mass murder, or a combination of the two. The report absolved Attorney General Janet Reno and top FBI officials of any blame. California Congressman Don Edwards complained today that the report is too easy on the Justice Department and the FBI. The German government says it wants to set up a $6 million fund for hemophiliacs who contracted AIDS through blood transfusions. But critics charge the fund is inadequate and comes years too late. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The Parliamentary Health Commission discussed the growing scandal in Germany over a cover-up in AIDS cases contracted through blood transfusions. Although an estimated 1,800 hemophiliacs contracted AIDS through contaminated blood transfusions in the mid-1980s, the information about 372 cases was first made public this week. Hemophiliac organizations say about 400 people have already died from AIDS. Earlier this week, the health minister dismissed several leading officials in the Federal Health Office for mismanaging information on AIDS cases through blood transfusions. Critics have for years charged the government and the pharmaceutical industry in Germany with collusion in covering up criminal negligence in the cases of hemophiliacs suffering from AIDS. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about a point to close at 3,585. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. President Clinton visited gunshot victims today at a hospital in New Jersey to draw attention to his call for gun control legislation. The president said Congress has delayed acting on handgun control and a ban on assault weapons for too long. The president also used the occasion to promote his health care reform package. He said that 80% of the people who go to hospitals because of violence don't have insurance, passing the cost on to other Americans. Five school-age boys have been killed in an attack by South African commandos raiding an alleged guerrilla hideout. The government said troops fired to protect themselves. In an additional development, conservative black and white parties have joined forces to form a so-called Freedom Alliance, which includes the Inkatha Freedom Party and the Afrikaner People's Front. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
This was a commando raid typical of a different era in South African politics. the attack was authorized by President de Klerk without any consultation with his negotiating partners. Already, black radical groups are talking of revenge. But the formation of the Conservative Freedom Alliance will probably prove the more significant development in the longer term. Both the ANC and the government now face the prospect of having to decide whether to effectively restart negotiations with Inkatha and the right wing. The two major parties had suspected that an agreement with Inkatha on the all-important constitution was in the offing. Instead, Chief Buthelezi has chosen to join a common front with people who are seeking to create states for ethnic groups and who want what amounts to independence rather than the federal system he espouses. The potential for serious problems in negotiations is considerable.
Fergal Keane in Johannesburg. Manufacturing jobs continued to wither away in September, but a strong gain in service sector jobs kept the employment rate steady at 6.7%. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Lennon would have celebrated his 53rd birthday tomorrow. Back in the 60s, when teenage girls in America and England fantasized about romance with their favorite Beatle, Cynthia Lennon held the position so many girls dreamed of. She was married to John Lennon. Cynthia Powell and John Lennon shared a working-class background. They met in art school in 1957 and were married in 1962. During the years that John toured the world as a member of the most popular rock group in history, Cynthia was at home raising their son, Julian. Cynthia and John Lennon divorced in 1968 after John fell in love with Yoko Ono. John Lennon was killed 12 years later. As her son Julian launched his own career as a musician, Cynthia Lennon developed her work as a designer. Terry Gross spoke with Cynthia Lennon in 1985. They spoke about the years that she was known as a Beatle wife and how their relationship started.
I met John Lennon at college when I went to junior art school and John went to secondary school. And I passed all my exams and I got into college, and John happened to be there at the same year as I was, but in different classes, because the first 2 years it's foundation course and you do different things, and I didn't really come across him until more or less the second year.
Was music an important part of his life then?
Well, he always carried around a battered old guitar over his shoulder, so I guessed it was at the time.
When you decided to get married, did you think you were going to have a pretty ordinary marriage?
Well, actually, we didn't decide to get married because it was a situation where we had to get married. You know, so we were rather irresponsible students at the time, and I became pregnant, and that's when we got married.
Did either of you resent that? Did you feel prepared for it?
Well, we were both totally shocked, and I was extremely ashamed because at the time it was a terrible crime. And it was something that we both were really, truly shocked about, but had to get on with it. And John accepted the responsibility, which was marvellous. I mean, he needn't have done, but he did.
Was he performing with the Beatles yet when you were married?
Yes, yes. He was just beginning to perform with Beatles. It was about the time that Brian Epstein signed them up that we were married, just about the beginning.
When did you realize that something very extraordinary was happening with that group?
Well, they were always extraordinary. Even as youngsters, as students, they were extraordinary. They had charisma about them. They had a great raw energy. And I think it was possibly when they were in Hamburg, when they first went to Hamburg, and they were out of the country, out of their hometown, and they were faced with an audience of ruffians and sailors, and they were working in the Reeperbahn in Hamburg. And they had to cope with different types of audiences, very hard, work very long hours. And that was when the magic started coming out, and that was their apprenticeship.
You were told by Brian Epstein after a while, the Beatles' manager, that you shouldn't be too visible as the wife. They didn't want the fans to know, I think, that that Lennon was married, or at least they didn't want to play it up. I mean, how were you told that? Did he tell you that directly?
Well, he didn't exactly tell me, but he did speak to John about it. And, of course, John explained to me the situation, because in those days it wasn't done for a pop star to have a wife. It would take away from the group. And, of course, the beginning of the Beatles, Brian wanted a lot of adulation from the fans. He wanted a lot of support from the fans. And, of course, it wasn't done. If the lead, in fact, the main man in the group, who was John, was found to be married, then it might take away from that particular success. So I walked round pregnant for quite a long time, hiding it. You know, I'd wear very big blousy clothes. And in fact, I was asked many times if I was John's wife, and I had to refuse and say, no, no, I'm somebody else.
Did John feel at all uncomfortable telling his wife not to act like his wife?
Well, it wasn't a sort of husband-wife situation, really. You know, again, it's very hard to describe because we had a son on the way and we were married very quickly and the Beatles started and the music started and the fame started and the press. And it wasn't a sort of natural, normal husband and wife situation at that time.
When fans did find out who you were, what kind of emotional reaction did they have toward you? Did a lot of the teenage girls really hate you or become jealous of you because you had the person who was the object of their fantasies?
Not at all. Do you know, I was very lucky, really. I think I expected it. I really was a little worried about it. But all I've ever had from the fans has been love and support. And if there was any envy or jealousy or hate, it didn't come across to me.
Did they want to live through you in a voyeuristic way?
In a way, yes. I think the fact that they wanted to wear the same makeup and wear their hair the same way and wear the same clothes, and that was flattering in a way, but it wasn't antagonistic at all.
It's funny, you know, you mentioned your hair, and you've mentioned that John Lennon wanted you to look like Brigitte Bardot, that he was really fixated
yes.
on Brigitte Bardot.
Yes, he was. He had plenty of posters of Brigitte Bardot and Mylène de Mongeau and many, all foreign. And, of course, a Liverpool girl trying to emulate that sort of style was something else. I couldn't change my accent to French, but the one thing that I could do was to grow my hair. And, of course, I started lightening it and it got lighter and lighter. And then he was very fascinated with black stockings and short skirts and, you know, and for me it was difficult at first because I was pretty conservative. They used to call me Miss Powell. You know, they used to think of me as a sort of secretary type with specs on, glasses on. And I always used to be kidded about it, and they'd always say, oh, here comes Miss Powell. And this was before John and I got together. And then, of course, when we did get together, I just... I didn't fall in, but I was influenced by him a lot. You know, of course, I mean, I loved him. So I did as much as I could to please him in that respect. And I pleased myself as well, because I was a little bit fed up with being called Miss Powell.
What was it like in the days when you were a young mother and John was mostly on the road touring and he'd have, I guess, like a couple of weeks here and there in between tours to come home and play the role of husband and father? Was he able to make that transition from rock star and figure of fantasy to young father and husband?
Extremely difficult for him, because even though when he wasn't on the road touring, he was in the recording studio. So we saw very little of him. And when he did come home, he was so exhausted and so tired and so overwhelmed by the pressures of the outside world that when he came home, all he wanted to do was to collapse. And he used to sleep an awful lot. And he would wake up when we were ready to go to bed, if you know what I mean. With a small child, you have to be up early in the morning, and then you're pretty exhausted at night. Whereas John's hours changed. You know, he'd be up at night and in bed during the day. So the whole fabric of our life changed because of the work that he was doing and because of the pressures from outside.
Cynthia Lennon speaking with Terry Gross. More of the interview after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
Let's return to Terry's conversation with Cynthia Lennon. This interview was recorded in 1985.
Were you exposed to any of the groupies who were hanging around John Lennon and the other Beatles then?
Well, actually, the first experience, which was funny for all of us, when we first came to New York and we were staying at the Plaza, I think it was Murray the K was there. He was the first disc jockey that we'd ever met, American disc jockey, so I was very impressed, but he happened to be there. And in the room, there were sort of all these draped, beautiful ladies. This was their suite, Murray the K, and about five beautiful model ladies all draped round. And we all walked in and looked at them and looked at each other and wondered what on earth we were supposed to do in a situation like this, because it was obvious, you know, what they were there for. And, of course, I was the fly in the ointment because I was the wife of one of the Beatles. So it was embarrassing for them and embarrassing for me. And it was a situation that clicked with me. I mean, I realised then what it was going to be like, you know, in the future. I mean, obviously, that was what it was going to be like, just women throwing themselves at them the whole time.
Well, what would you do in a situation like that? Would you be the one to leave?
No, no. I mean, in a situation like that, no. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're not there, there's not a lot you can do about it, is there? And, you know, men are very easily tempted when they're exhausted and tired and they need not necessarily sleep. You know, I'm not being crude on this, but I mean, it's one of those situations in that sort of life.
Did you ever have a desire to have other relationships too, since chances were that he was having other relationships?
Not at all. No, I'm a one-man woman. I always have been. And very difficult. You know, I suppose it sounds not boring, but, you know, in this day and age, there's so much infidelity and all sorts of things going on. But no, I'm a one-man woman, and I believed and loved my man at the time. And there was no way I would have dreamt doing anything like that.
One of the changes that he experienced, which I would assume you didn't, at least to that degree, was the introduction of marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, the Beatles became famous for mm-hmm. that. Did you participate in any of that? Were you anxious to try it?
I was never anxious to try it. But our first experience was a friend of George's, actually, a dentist person, and we went for dinner, and after dinner he put sugar cubes in our coffee, which were laced with LSD, and of course it hit us all at the same time, and we had the most horrendous night and a very dangerous drive home. We could all have been killed because we were absolutely out of our minds, and for me that was hell, sheer hell, mental torture, and I couldn't cope with it. And I would never, ever have wanted to do it again. And yet for John, it was something else. You see, John was a different animal. He was a searcher. He desired something new in life, constantly changing, constantly wanting new experiences. And, of course, he didn't have a bad time on this particular drug. So he tried it again. And then if you realise at a time like that, when there's so much money around and so many hangers-on, there are bound to be pushers, and there were pushers. We were surrounded by pushers, so there was no denying that there was plenty of supplies. You know, they didn't have to do anything. They were captive audiences to these people who are constantly pushing the drugs.
Did that create a wedge between the two of you, since he was living in an altered state a lot of the time and you weren't?
Most definitely, because it's division of two minds, really. I couldn't go along with it. I just couldn't. I hated the whole business. I could see what it was doing, not necessarily to John, but to a lot of people. Lost a lot of friends through drugs. And with John, it altered his personality for me. I mean, I just stayed the way I was, and I always have done as far as I can. I mean, I've developed and I've gone on. But John was going so fast, and I couldn't keep up with him. And I didn't want to keep up with him on that level.
What are some of the other ways you saw him changed by the fame and the money that he achieved?
I think he became extremely lethargic at home, really rather sad and tired. He just didn't have any stimulation anymore. He was losing out on concert tours. He wasn't happy in his performance because he couldn't hear himself. He wasn't getting any audience response. He wasn't close enough to the people that he was entertaining anymore. I mean, he was surrounded by adulation and material goods and all the things that other people would think were fantastic in life. But for John, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't honest enough.
So what did it look like he was going to turn to instead?
Well, I think it was very hard to describe what he was going to turn to. I mean, he was on that particular road. We did turn to meditation and Maharishi in India.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I was there for 2 months. But he took that wholeheartedly again, and so did George, very, very deeply into meditation. And I didn't. I took half and half, sort of tried to get a balanced view of it. So I would do artwork. Half of my time was doing artwork and half of my time was doing meditation because I didn't want to get hooked on anything. You know, I think you've got to believe in yourself and your capabilities. And I think John again was looking for an escape. But this time it was a healthy escape. It was escape into meditation, into peace of mind, relaxation, away from the pressures. And it was at this particular time that he met Yoko. And, of course, again, before we went to India, Brian died. So the whole thing, our whole lifestyle changed again very quickly, you know, after the first time. And it was constantly changing. And this was a great break and a great rift for all of us. I mean, we're all devastated by Brian's death.
How did you first meet Yoko?
I met her... Oh, where was it? Actually, when I came home from a holiday. But I had seen her before. I mean, I met her physically, we could say. And she'd been staying with John the night, and I came home and they were there, which was sort of curtains for our marriage as far as all of us were concerned, really. But I had met her once before at a meditation meeting.
You knew right from the start when you saw them together that this was it, that this was different from just having an affair with someone?
Well, I keep saying it was feminine intuition. You know that something's going to happen, and only you know that something like that is going to happen because of your sensitivity and your knowledge of the person that you've been living with for 10 years already. You know exactly what's going to happen. And as far as Yoko was concerned, I knew there was not a thing I could do about it, any more than there was anything I could do about John taking drugs at the time. There was no way I could have stopped him.
He initiated divorce proceedings, right?
Yes.
And he accused you of adultery.
Well, you see, this is the madness of it all. I, to this day, don't understand that, but it's almost as though, I've tried to work it out, it's almost as though John's attitude in life was the best form of defense is attack. Now, he was guilty of letting me down in public. I was on holiday when the information about John and Yoko came out in the newspapers. I didn't know it was open to the world, the situation. And I was on holiday and somebody showed me a newspaper. And then an emissary of John's came over to visit me in Italy and said, John wants a divorce and he wants Julian. And there's a detective. Now, I was on holiday with my mother, my aunt and uncle, and Julian. So God only knows why there was a detective put on me. You know, it was one of those situations that I will never understand.
You still angry about that?
No, I'm not. I'm really not angry. If I could understand it more, it would be easier. But I didn't get a chance to have an explanation for it. I'm not angry about it. I'm really not. It's just... It's in the past. It's finished. It's done.
Were you able to talk with him? Would he make time to talk with you about the divorce proceedings?
Not really. It was all done through lawyers and solicitors.
That must have been very frustrating.
It was very sad. Very sad that you were cut off so quickly. Cut out of somebody's life so quickly. But... there's not a lot I can say about that.
I can't imagine what it was like for you, you know, to, after going from the, you know, fairly conservative childhood to suddenly being in the middle of all the Beatlemania stuff, and then it ends, you know, then there's a divorce, and you're still kind of identified with it, but it's in a lot of ways out of your life. And you didn't have the money anymore either.
No. Well, I think it's called survival. It's simple as that. I think you have to survive, and you have to keep your feet on the ground and hope for the best and keep on laughing, you know, in life. I'm not laughing now, but, I mean, you must carry on. I had a son to look after. I had a child to bring up. And what if I'd fallen by the wayside, what would have happened to him? Very important. Julian was very important to me at that time.
When John and Yoko went off together, their relationship was probably the most press-covered relationship of the year. They were on the cover of everything. Mm-hmm. They were holding press conferences in their bed. I mean, it was one big media event after another. How much of that did you want to expose yourself to? Did you read it?
Oh, I read everything, yes. Because, of course, the man that we had divorced, it didn't mean to say I'd stopped loving him or caring for him or worrying about him. I mean, because I didn't have any anger or bitterness about it. I had a lot of hurt. But of course I was looking after his interests in my own little way and caring about his future and hoping that he was happy, because he'd had to go through such hell to do what he did. And he became almost a leper in the eyes of the British and the press. And he had hell to go through because he broke away from the system of being one of the four mop tops that were doing so well and such good ambassadors for Britain. And he moved out of that and he became an individual. And he did what he wanted, to the extreme, as John would always do anyway. And I felt extremely worried for him, really, at that time, because he had to take so much from the press and media and from fans and people who loved him.
How do you think his personality was changed by the relationship?
I think he found his space. I don't think he found the complete satisfaction in life, because I think he was always searching, always looking for it, always wanting something new, always. I mean, he was due to come back to England, you know, near the end, just before he died. So he was constantly changing and looking for new quests. But whatever he did, it was totally honest and wholehearted.
Cynthia Lennon speaking with Terry Gross in a 1985 interview from the Fresh Air Archives. Cynthia Lennon married John Lennon in 1962. They were divorced in 1968. This is Fresh Air. In the second half of our show, we'll hear from Lennon's second wife, Yoko Ono.
One, two, three, five!
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, more on John Lennon, who would have been 53 years old tomorrow. Most of us know Lennon's second wife, Yoko Ono, only as a kind of footnote, wife to one of the most important rock artists of our generation. But before Yoko Ono met John Lennon, she was establishing a name for herself as an artist. We'll hear from Yoko Ono in an interview from the Fresh Air Archives. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the music that influenced the young John Lennon. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. One day after setting a date for U.S. troops to leave Somalia, President Clinton said that there are obligations in other places, so a March 31st deadline will be met. As more than 5,000 U.S. troops head for Somalia, Mr. Clinton indicated that he is willing to let fugitive factional leader General Adid take part in efforts to find a political solution in Somalia. UN military officials say the bodies of two missing soldiers have been recovered in Somalia, raising the number of those killed in Sunday's fighting to 15. At least three U.S. soldiers are still missing. Meanwhile, a Red Cross delegate was able to visit captured U.S. pilot Michael Durant. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Nairobi.
Red Cross officials said a delegate met alone with Chief Warrant Officer Durant at an undisclosed site in Mogadishu. The organization released few details, saying only that Durant seemed to be in fairly good condition and had written a message to be delivered to his family. Today's visit was facilitated by associates of Somali factional leader Mohamed Farah Aidid. An Aidid associate this week said Durant's release is dependent on the United Nations freeing some two dozen Somali prisoners. Representatives of an Aidid faction today also gave the Red Cross a body believed to be an American killed in Sunday's fighting. A Red Cross spokesman said the body was turned over to UN officials in Mogadishu. I'm Ann Cooper in Nairobi.
A government report has cleared the FBI of wrongdoing in its handling of the tear gas assault in the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas, last April. The ensuing fire, an apparent mass suicide, claimed the lives of at least 85 people. The report issued today was written by Philadelphia attorney Edward Dennis, a longtime prosecutor who served in the Bush administration. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Dennis concluded that the FBI had acted professionally and with restraint, that the Attorney General exercised, quote, extraordinary oversight, that she considered all the options and chose what she reasonably viewed as the least risky. Throughout his report, Dennis reiterated his conclusion that David Koresh had no intention of ever giving himself up or releasing the bulk of his followers. But Dennis did theorize that a different handling of the negotiations might have produced the release of at least some more people from the compound. He pointed to the disagreements between the FBI negotiating team and the FBI tactical forces. The negotiators, he said, were upset that on a number of occasions when Koresh sent people out of the compound, the tactical forces, instead of rewarding Koresh, increased the pressure, piping loud noises into the compound and driving tanks around. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 1 point to close at 3,584.74 on volume of 243 million shares. This is NPR News. In Moscow, government officials are moving ahead with plans to hold new elections to parliament in December and say that a new constitution might also be on the ballot. Members of the old parliament had blocked many efforts by Russian President Boris Yeltsin to move the country to a free market economy, and so last month he disbanded parliament and called for new elections. This led to a two-week standoff with hardline members of Congress, whose leaders are now in jail. There are news reports in Moscow that hardline leaders will likely be charged with betrayal, for which they could receive the death sentence. In Bosnia, fighting is continuing in different parts of the country. Attacks are occurring in the central part of the nation, with Serbian factions said to be advancing on a besieged Muslim area in the east. Meanwhile, the UN has stopped flying wounded civilians out of Bosnia. Matt Fry of the BBC has more on the story.
When three Serbian civilians, all suffering from cancer, were put on the evacuation list earlier this week, the Bosnian government said it would allow them to leave only if eight wounded Muslim soldiers and police officers were also evacuated. The UNHCR spokesman here said that this linkage amounted to a cruel political game. Just how political is obvious from the name that topped the Bosnian list. Izmet Bajramović, known as Čelo, is the 29-year-old Muslim gangster who controlled Sarajevo's lucrative black market. He was wounded in a gangland assassination attempt last week. Most surprising is that Bosnia's foreign minister, Haris Silajic, personally asked the UN to evacuate Čelo, who spent 5 years in jail for rape before the war, and who is feared by many as the most powerful man in the Bosnian capital. The request to fly out Čelo prompted the Serbs to put a halt to medical evacuations, which can only take place if all sides agree.
Matt Fry of the BBC reporting from Sarajevo. In trading in Europe, the dollar moved down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon.
Hold on, John. John, hold on. It's gonna be all right. Gonna win the fight. Hold on, Yoko, Yoko, hold on. It's gonna be all right.
Let's continue our archives edition of Fresh Air, marking John Lennon's birthday, with an interview Terry Gross recorded with Yoko Ono. Most of us know Yoko Ono through her relationship to Lennon, but before they met, Ono was an avant-garde artist living in New York, where her circle of friends included John Cage, Merce Cunningham, and Lamont Young. An exhibit of Ono's recent work has just opened at the Cranbrook Academy of Art Museum in Michigan. John Lennon was murdered in 1980. After many years of relative seclusion, Yoko Ono reemerged to the public through her art. A retrospective of her work at the Whitney Museum of Art in New York included Play It By Trust, a chess set of all-white pieces, and Bottoms, a film featuring the naked behinds of 365 people. That exhibit was mounted in 1989, and that's when Yoko Ono spoke with Terry Gross.
Do you think your work was seen differently after you and John got together, your artwork?
Definitely, definitely.
How?
Well, I was just an artist before that, and then I became Mrs. Lennon, you know. And there's a piece called Box of Smile. I was still sort of, didn't understand my position, you know, looking from outside, that is. I didn't understand how I looked. So I was still feeling like an artist and just went on creating things. So it was very natural for me to try to put a Box of Smile out in the world. And I put an ad in the Village Voice saying it's, was it $2 or $5? Very cheap. You know, $5 a box or something like that, you know. And then somebody, I think it's one of the rock critics or something, you know, sort of, and he was visiting John and me and so saying, why are you selling your artwork, you know? And I was saying, well, why not, you know? And he said, well, I mean, you're Mrs. Lennon and you should be giving it away, you know. And he, oh, dear, charity lady, you know, what is this? You know, and you wouldn't say that to John, why don't you give away records? I mean, what are we talking about? You know, and there was a big sort of discussion, you know. But basically, that was the kind of natural feeling people had. I think, well, she's Mrs. Lennon, you know. What's she doing anyway? I mean, she doesn't have to work anymore, you know. So, I don't know. I just went on creating things, but then in 71, I think, we did an Emerson Museum show, which was in Syracuse. And I say we because John was a guest artist, and I wanted him to be a guest artist, really, and it was really nice. But, I mean, for us, it was a great celebration because opening was on John's birthday, and I felt that I was sort of doing the show for him and all that kind of thing. But I think most people queued up to see John, you know. And, well, that's another kind of event, another kind of happening. It was okay, but there was no point in creating the kind of pieces that I was creating.
You grew up both in Japan and the United States. You moved to the States when you were 2 and a half because your father was working here. And then I think it was right before the war you moved back to Japan. And then when you were a teenager, you moved back to the States again. And I was wondering, during the period when you were in the States, right before the war and then again after the war, if you were exposed to a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment.
Yes, that's another thing. I went through strange times. but also I think that that's part of my being in a way. And so it became a part of my being. So it was a good experience, let's put it that way. But first I came to the United States when I was 2.5 years old to see my father. And then I went back to Japan to go to school. And then I came back to New York to go to school again or something. And then the war was going to start, and there was a great tension, and a lot of Japanese were advised to go back to Japan. And then soon after I went back to Japan, the war broke out. You know. So when I heard the news that we're fighting America, I mean, it was like most of my friends were in America, you know, and they were Americans. So it was a very strange kind of situation. In United States, they were always, you know, thinking of us as, I don't know, the yellow people or whatever. And my friends were very nice to me, but if I walked around in town, some sort of strange kids would throw stones at me or something like that. Those things did occur. Films, when you go to a theater, all films were about, you know, the dirty Orientals and the dragon ladies and the baddies and all that bit, you know. So it was very strange. And then I go back to Japan, and I'm sort of like saying, no, we're not bad, you know, and we're sort of, I'm talking like I'm representing America, you know. And so in both countries, I was sort of like trying to put a point through that actually the other country was not that bad, and I represent the other country. That's how I felt about it.
Yoko Ono speaking with Terry Gross. We'll have more of the interview after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return now to Terry's conversation with Yoko Ono. This interview was recorded in 1989.
After you and John got together, you started singing on on records together and in concerts. And I would like to know how you developed the kind of singing that you did. And let me just play a minute of one of your recordings before we talk about it.
Okay, go ahead.
This is from the Plastic Ono Band Live Piece in Toronto concert in 1969. Mm-hmm. And this is John, Let's Hope for Peace. My guest, Yoko Ono, was recorded in 1969. How did you start singing that way?
I really don't know. I mean, I started to do experimental voice stuff when I was in New York in the avant-garde scene and all that. And I thought I was doing some quite original stuff. I think that around 1961 or whatever, around that time, I think it was pretty original. But now I listen to this John, Let's Hope for Peace. It wasn't, you know, it's a jam basically. And sadly, I mean, you know, it wasn't just sort of experienced and forgotten as a jam song, but of course John being so famous and all that. So, and it was a moment in history, probably, and it was recorded and every, you know, I don't know. If you hear it now, I don't know. It's just, it lacks the atmosphere of the jam, so you just hear it musically and you think, oh, well, I mean, what was she doing? I mean, it's so, you know, unpleasant to listen to or something like that.
Do you like it listening back?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't listen back to my music anyway, unless it's sort of like a song that I was interested in. I might just pick up, you know, and sort of listen it back for some reason to sort of check out, oh, well, did I use that chord or, you know, that riff or something? Maybe, you know, when I do a new record or something like that, I just go back to doing that. I wouldn't listen to my jam stuff or anything like that. But some of the things I did was pretty interesting, probably. But it seems like it has a kind of very oriental background, you know? So, which I was not aware of, really, at the time.
There was a lot of hostile reaction to you when you and John first got together. And I was wondering if you think it would have been different had you not been Asian, had you been a little bit younger, you were a few years older than John. And had you not had a kind of weird art career of your own, do you think that you were punished in a way by the public for any of those things?
Well, yes, probably, you know. Well, we all know that, don't we? But I think that now, I think it was something that we went through together, all of us. It was a lesson, a learning for us, in a way. If you observed closely, you would have noticed that the age difference is really, I mean, the physical age difference really didn't mean very much. I mean, now most people, I mean, some women would live with somebody who's 30 years younger and all that, nobody's surprised. I was only 8 years older than John, and John was a very worldly man by then. In a strange sort of way, I was not as worldly as him. So in that sense, I looked up to him in many ways. And in some ways, he was my daddy, you know, father figure too, you know. And so between us, we never felt the sort of difference of age or something like that, you know.
I've thought of you over the past few years as living a very secluded life. And I was actually really surprised when I found out that you would be willing to do an interview. Is this a sign of a change in your life, of being a little more public? Because after being going through a very public period, you went through years of a very private period. Are you coming out of that now? Is this a sign of that?
Well, I think that there was a private period that was very necessary because... sometimes it's like breathing in and out, you know. You just have to go inside yourself, and that period was the Dakota period or whatever you call it. And then we came out with the Double Fantasy, and from then on, I think we would have been pretty public for a while, you know. I, again, went into hiding in some ways because of what happened, and I just couldn't sort of deal with it in a way, and I needed to hide. But even while I was hiding, I think, you know, there's some statements that I put out or whatever. I was in touch with life itself. You know, it wasn't like I sort of denied it all, you know, and sort of shut myself out of it. I don't think I was part of society.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Yoko Ono speaking with Terry Gross in a 1989 interview from the Fresh Air Archives. An exhibit of Ono's recent work has just opened at the Cranbrook Academy of Art Museum in Michigan. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel joins us with a preview of All Things Considered. Robert, how are you covering President Clinton's policy change on Somalia?
Well, we'll be hearing from Ted Clark, who's covering the State Department, telling us what they said in the way of elaboration today. Also, an interview with Madeleine Albright, United Nations Ambassador of the United States. She says, and the people of the State Department say, that come March 31st of next year, prisoners notwithstanding and political progress notwithstanding, the U.S. is out of Somalia. Also today, we'll be hearing about the Russian military's nuclear doomsday machine. And we'll be talking with Bill Harney, who is an Australian Aborigine who tells wonderful stories about the Waterman people.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward went back to Ray Coleman's 1984 biography of John Lennon, and he found some clues about the music John might have been listening to in the early days of the Beatles and before.
John Lennon's first group was the Quarrymen, and they were a skiffle band. Skiffle was a big fad in England in the late 50s, and the easiest way of explaining it is to say that it was American folk music played on a combination of acoustic guitars and homemade instruments, usually badly. Leadbelly's train song, Rock Island Line, was the cornerstone of any decent skiffle group's repertoire, and those of you with strong stomachs can seek out Lonnie Donegan's version of that. But the rock and roll influence was already there. We know that the Quarrymen also performed Mickey and Sylvia's classic, Love is Strange, although I bet none of them could play guitar as well as Mickey Baker could. When John met Paul McCartney, the chemistry between them was so strong that they started writing songs together almost immediately. But in Ray Coleman's Lennon biography, we also learn that at their first rehearsals, Paul brought in Little Richard's Rip It Up, and John contributed this Buddy Holly classic.
There you go, invited. Here am I, oh, will you? Left me here so I could sit and cry. Well, golly gee, what have you done to me? Oh, well, I guess it doesn't matter anymore.
As many of you know, Buddy Holly and the Crickets were very important to John. Beatles was a name coined in direct imitation of Crickets. Once the Beatles got going, the emphasis was on learning hit tunes that their audience would recognize, and so the early Beatles had plenty of Little Richard and Chuck Berry songs in their set list, numbers that are still familiar to most of today's rock and roll fans. But then as now, there were American rock and roll artists who were much more popular in Britain than in the U.S., people like Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran, and this guy.
Anna.
Arthur Alexander's Anna was his only U.S. hit, but he was a big favorite in Britain, where lots of groups, not only the Beatles, covered his songs, including the Rolling Stones, who recorded You'd Better Move On. And although the Stones were more famous for doing such a thing, there's at least one instance where the Beatles took an obscure song and improved it. Since John was such a big girl group fan, revamping the B-side of the Shirelles' hit Will You Love Me Tomorrow was probably his idea. The important thing to remember is that these weren't oldies. They were hits of the day, and the Beatles were trying to stay contemporary. They didn't know they were changing the sound of pop music. They just understood when they heard something new, they should do it, like this. Listening to the harmonica on Bruce Chanel's Hey Baby, John knew he had to try that himself, and the song led directly to his writing Love Me Do. The harmonica player, by the way, was a young lad from Fort Worth named Delbert McClinton. John Lennon remembered the songs of his youth for his entire life. Not only did he cut that album Rock and Roll in the post-Beatles days, but in one late Beatle classic, he snuck in a line from Chuck Berry's You Can't Catch Me.
New Jersey Turnpike in the wee-wee hours. I was rolling slow because of drizzling showers. Yeah, come a flat top, he was moving up with me. Then come waving goodbye in a little old souped-up jitney. I put my foot in my tank and I began to roll. Moaning siren towards the state patrol. So I let out my wings and then I blew my horn. Bye-bye, New Jersey, I become airborne. Now you can't catch me. Baby, you can't catch me.
I know. I always thought that flat top line from Come Together sounded familiar. Who knows how John Lennon would have spent this birthday? Certainly I don't. But if he'd spent a part of the day reflecting on the half-century behind him, maybe he'd have played some of these records.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. John Lennon would have been 53 years old tomorrow. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Joan Tuohy, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Salad, with help from Nancy Greenlease. Our interns are Devin Reif and Abby Fanta. Danny Miller is our senior producer. Roberta Schirach directs the show. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Chris Spurgeon.
Okay.
Look at me. Who am I supposed to be? Who am I supposed to be? Look at me. What am I supposed to be? What am I supposed to be?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
With an overnight low of 55 degrees, the rain continuing through tomorrow. And you're listening to 91 FM.